Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Just a quick intro to PitchLink. In 2013, Serious Decisions reported 60 to 70% of content churned out by B2B marketing departments today sits unused. IDC weighed in with their own concerning statistic. Sales team members don't use as much as 80% of the content that marketing generates. We all get the picture. But how to stop the bleed? In PitchLink, marketing team can build pitches to order for sales folks and have them along the creation journey so that every pitch ever created is made to order and used. Want to know more? Sign up for a free one-on-one session. Our guest today is Ethan Butte, Chief Evangelist at BombBomb, host of the Customer Experience Podcast and co-author of Human-Centered Communication.
You know, if we are to be successful in the future, it's going to be meeting people where they are and serving their needs and interests first. And I think we've become so enamored of the powerful and inexpensive technology that we've really set these machines off to do a lot of our work for us without truly testing the boundaries of what's scalable and what's unscalable. I think a lot of people will take that personal and human approach and say, oh, that doesn't scale. And so we set it on the side and we stop doing the things that truly emotionally connect with people and make a big difference in our business. But it's hard to measure that difference.
Ethan Butte has spent the past decade helping business professionals be more personal and human through simple video messages. He has sent more than 12,000 videos himself. He also spent a dozen years leading marketing teams inside local television stations in Chicago, Grand Rapids, and Colorado Springs. He holds undergraduate and graduate degrees from the University of Michigan and UCCS in communication, psychology, and marketing. He also co-authored Rehumanize Your Business. He lives in Colorado Springs with his wife and son. Now on to this insightful episode with Ethan Butte. Ethan, welcome to the show. I'm so glad that we could make time and you could make time and be here to talk about your new book.
Yeah, it's a privilege and a pleasure. I'm happy to be here and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Wonderful. Before we actually get into the book, tell us a bit about yourself, the work you have been doing. You have been doing some spectacular work, so talk about that. Let's get a feel of what you are up to.
Sure, that's a very kind way to set that question up. I appreciate it. So I've been, interestingly, been at BombBomb, a software company that makes it easy to record and send video messages in a variety of channels, including email, LinkedIn, Slack, etc. I've been here full-time for 10 years, which is twice as long as my longest stay anywhere and about 3 or 4x my average stay everywhere throughout my career. And so I also think that's generally atypical. In the software space, I think people tend to move around a lot. And it's really, I've been really reflective around this milestone because, you know, I just think about the depth of intimacy I've been able to achieve by committing a decade of my life to this team and this work and this idea and this community and this philosophy and this practice of reaching out in more personal and human ways. And so that depth of intimacy, of course, is with the leadership team. Many of us have been together for 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Of course, with our customers, I have personal relationships with hundreds of our customers. And, you know, with the ideas themselves, I've written 2.5 books. We can talk about the half book if we want to. But, you know, I've sent more than 12,000 video messages myself. And it's just, you don't get that deep into an idea unless you commit the time to it. I never would have been in a conversation with you about these topics if I had only committed, say, 2 or 3 or 4 years. So it's been a really great decade. This is an emergent philosophy and practice using video messages in place of what would typically be faceless typed out text. Over the past few years, we've had a lot more competition come into the space. Many of them are backed by, you know, tens of millions of dollars of some of the smartest venture capital in the space, which validates this idea that we established, you know, about a dozen years ago and have been, you know, in the market with for about a decade. From a bootstrapped position. So I started as VP marketing, first and only marketer for a while, grew the team out with our CMO and my co-author on both books, Rehumanize Your Business and Human-Centered Communication. And it's just been a really fun and interesting journey from, you know, 6 or 7 employees and a couple of hundred customers to, you know, 150 employees and about 70,000 customers. It's just been really fun and interesting to grow this. Prior to that, and then I'll give it back to you, prior to that, I spent a dozen years running marketing inside local television stations in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in Chicago, and out here in Colorado Springs where I live now. And so prior to, you know, at the start of my career, I started by writing, producing, and editing spots, television ads, or commercials to support the station and its programming, and then eventually grew out to, you know, of course, building campaigns of various elements and running teams of people doing the same. And so that's where I am now. It's a little bit about how I got there, and I appreciate, again, that kind setup.
This is quite fascinating. Of course, I think I'm very tempted to invite you to my other show, where I talk to you know, SaaS founders and get into the whole BombBomb story. It is that's very tempting, but I'll resist that today, and okay. I will get back to the book. So tell me, you wrote this book, Rehumanizing Business, and then you wrote this one. What is it that you left out in the previous book that prompted you to consider writing a new book?
Yeah, really great question. So the first book was born out of my pride and excitement and the promise of, you know, again, this philosophy and practice that we've established and I think been a real leader in, which is using simple, personal, casual, conversational video messages to communicate more clearly, to connect with people more effectively, and ultimately to get people to say yes more often, you know, not in a manipulative way, but because we're communicating in a much more complete and satisfying and whole way that, you know, is more connective, persuasive, emotive, visual, et cetera. The things that human brains and human emotional systems need and want from other human beings that have been missing from so much of our digital communication. So that first book, I hit my 6-year anniversary full time at BombBomb, and I was just so excited about where we had come and how passionate people are about this movement and this practice, and, you know, how much we've grown as a team and as a company and as a customer community and as a broader community. Again, as competition comes into the space, that's part of the growing community. And so I just started writing that book kind of, you know, between 5 and 6 in the morning in the better part of a Saturday or a Sunday. And I was probably 10,000 words into it before anyone besides my wife and son knew that I was writing it. And it really is the complete what, why, who, when, and how of this movement that we call relationships through video in order to draw a line against marketing through video. For human-centered communication, which will be releasing, you know, in a couple of weeks. I don't know when this episode will release. It may be live already. But for that one, which we started about 2.5 years later, or 2 years later, Steve's original premise. So I started that one and roped Steve into it as my co-author. And it's, I recommend anyone who's going to write a nonfiction business book, if you can get a co-author or like a really close collaborator, definitely do it. It's a better book for teaming up, just as a sanity check so you're not as lonely, et cetera. That'd be another podcast conversation. Yes. Because it can be a lonely process. There are a lot of hours there. And you get into your own head about, you know, is this good? Is this helpful? Is this clear, et cetera? Now, of course, a good editor can help you with that too. But, you know, having a co-author intimately alongside takes that process to a different level and I think a better one. And so in this one, Steve reached out to me. We would playfully say periodically, like, hey, I know what the second book is going to be. And for a while, it was like, no, man, too soon. We're not ready to do that. Like, you know, we just got done with the other one. In this case, his idea was, okay, let's go wider than video email and video messaging, and let's go deeper into human connection and identify some of the broader problems of this increasing noise and pollution in all these digital, virtual, and online spaces that we have to operate in now. Of course, the pandemic drove some of that, but you won't see the word COVID or pandemic on a single page in this book, because this would exist whether or not the pandemic ever existed, this movement toward these spaces. And so Steve's idea was like, hey, good news. I got an idea, and you know, here's the premise of it, and you won't have to write very much of it. The idea was, let's invite some of our expert friends who are specialists and experts in their own right in a variety of these other modes of communicating digitally, building trust and relationship digitally, oftentimes using video to do those things, virtually, online, digitally, et cetera. And we made a short list of people we definitely wanted to invite into the conversation, and all of them said yes. But when we started doing the initial interviews, just like pre-interviews, like, here's the idea, what do you think? You know, just getting some feedback from the people who would be intimately involved in it and ultimately give us hours and hours of their time. We pitched this idea of, hey, like, you write the chapter, and then, you know, we'll add some commentary on the front or back of it, and then we'll bookend the whole thing, and it'll have this flow to it. And pretty much everyone, even someone like Shep Hyken, who's, you know, a New York Times, Wall Street Journal bestselling author of like 9 books now, he's like, yeah, I don't really want to write a chapter. No one wanted to write a chapter. And so we turned it into interviews, which we can get into. But that was the premise of it. And so it was fun to take this principle of using video messages in place of typed out text and just blow it out and go wider. Why do we do that? Why is it better? Where else does that philosophy and concept translate? And it translates all over the place. The same reason we would use a 45-second video message to follow up to say something like a thank you message like this, as a thank you to you hosting me in a conversation like this, applies in so many other places. It's because you can feel the sincerity, you can feel the enthusiasm, you can feel the gratitude. You know that it's for you and about you, and it comes uniquely from me. And that applies in other places. And so that's this concept of human-centered communication, which we can dive into more. So it's an expansion of the first one, which is really a practical guide with stories and examples and, you know, when should we do this? Why should we do this? What are the common pitfalls? How do we do it? In this case, we're taking it and blowing out much wider to so much more of our digital experience with customers, with employees, and everybody else we need to connect and communicate with online.
Great. So let's step back a bit. I mean, original idea, get some experts, let them write some chapters, you will bookend them with commentary, didn't work out. At this stage, did you have any structure in mind that this is what we are going to cover?
No. Well, yes and no. So, Steve and I got commitments, and we shifted it to, they would all agree to do like a 90-minute or 2-hour interview with us. And so prior to that, we would do so together, Steve and I created a common question list, which started with really high level things like, what is your guiding business or life philosophy? And then, you know, what role do human relationships play in relation to your guiding business or life philosophy? And then what role does video communication play in building relationships related to your guiding business philosophy? So we would start in that kind of high level thing. And then we had a set of common questions. We could go different directions with each person. And so we created this question list that would be, I mean, gosh, if we ran it top to bottom in full, it'd be a 4-hour interview probably for most people. So that was where we started first, after we started lining up the interviews. And then Steve and I would read their books, listen to their podcasts, watch their YouTube videos, read their blog posts, follow them on social. And we were already connected with and knew some of these people. Right. In some cases, we just knew of them professionally. In other cases, we knew them very personally and already spent hours in person or, you know, on Zoom or in a Skype call like this, in other conversations. And so we had varying degrees of familiarity with them. But through this additional research that Steve and I each did going into the interviews, we were able to tweak and customize and throw out large chunks of that big general question list and make it a really unique and specific interview to them. So we didn't know what exactly we wanted from each of these people, but we knew the zone we were in.
Right.
And interestingly, last thing here, and I'll give it back so you can redirect me. Internally at BombBomb, we had a cross-functional team exploring this idea of, we know that video email is the mechanical, functional part of what we provide people, but we know that that's just the mechanical, functional level of what we provide people. So they were in conversation and exploration of, like, we know that what we're doing with and for our customers is bigger than sending video messages, because as you were clever enough to point out in the beginning, if we don't do it well, if we don't make it about the other person, if we don't communicate our intent and our motivation to other people when we turn our cameras on, then we're potentially contributing to the pollution. And so what is that about? You know, what is the difference? And the difference is the person. And so when I can think about this segment of 47 people, or even 521 people, or that one person that I'm trying to reach or connect with on a live video call or in a recorded video message or any of the other places I'm communicating, if I can make it about them and make it easy for them to understand why they're getting it, what it's about, that I have their best interests in mind, the things that humans are naturally judging all the time, whether we're in person or online, and there are a number of impoverishments in our digital communication. It's emotionally and visually impoverished. So what can we do to satisfy the human need to understand, what's my opportunity here? Is it safe to proceed? Should I proceed? How do I even proceed if I do want to? And so we ended up with the language human-centered communication, with obviously the big challenge and impediment, not only to the limitations of the digital channels, but also this increasing digital pollution that pervades every digital space that we operate in. And so an internal team is coming up with this language and this approach. Steve and I are out doing these in-depth interviews, and toward the, you know, after we had all the raw material, there was this process of trying to organize it in a manner that would honor both of those efforts. And I think it emerged in a very coherent package in human-centered communication, subtitle, A Business Case Against Digital Pollution. So it was fun. It was challenging. It was a pleasure. It was, there's certainly a creative process to get the flow down between the individual people, because this chapters 3 through 13 are very much about these individual practitioners and what guides them and what they've learned in their careers and how they approach their online and virtual communication, sometimes with employees and potential recruits, very often with customers and potential customers, and ultimately with all of the stakeholders that are directly and indirectly responsible for our success in our businesses.
So the sense I'm getting is the structure of the book was pretty fluid till the time you nailed all the interviews, and potentially the actual structure that we see today came about later and not at the beginning.
Yeah, very much. I'm a worrying type of person. I operate very much from fear and imagining what could go wrong. And so, you know, I had those concerns early on, and I had some anxiety about it. Like, I know we have a ton of good material here, but the shape wasn't clear yet. And so we started doing these interviews late last summer into the fall. I think the last one we conducted was in October or November of 2020. And that language emerged from our team internally sometime around that same window, October or so. And so that's when I really started mashing it up a little bit and trying to figure out what shape it could take. And I started writing properly. It's toward the end of December. And because I had these heavyweight outlines, because I would, you know, take the recorded interviews and get a transcript of them and you know, I was working like loose outlines as on my screen, I was manipulating the large passages of quotes and the unique stories that each person told. I was working with this and kind of thinking about it and worrying about it all along. And so I think something really good came together. And so what you have, of course, is an introduction. And if anyone wants that introduction, you can just email me, Ethan, ETHAN@bombbomb.com. And I'll just send you the full introduction. and have the introduction. First chapter is the definition of digital pollution. That's the heaviest, longest chapter, what it is, why it matters, how it hurts us, whether or not we are polluters ourselves. And then the next chapter is this philosophy of human-centered communication, which blends the 30 or 40-year-old practice of human-centered design with daily digital virtual online communication. So what is that? Why do these things go together? How can we apply these principles of human-centered design to what we're doing every day? And then we start getting into these kind of person-featured chapters through chapter 13. And then at 14, we round up. We make the people in the chapters talk to each other in part as a recap and in part as a, you know, seeing where they intersect. There are a couple points where people's opinions and philosophies and practices diverge. And so chapter 14 is kind of a roundup of the key strategies and philosophies we explored with these people. 15 is the tips and tactics, the more practical level of what these folks shared. And again, mostly they agree, but sometimes they don't. A key one was virtual backgrounds. Always do it, never do it, you know? And then chapter 16 is, as it often is in a book like this, is kind of a look to the future. So I look at a current emergent trend in this space, which is the application of deep fake technology. And, you know, what does that mean? What does that say about human-centered communication? And I just really try to hammer home the idea that we don't need to throw anything away. This is simply a restoration of balance toward the more personal and the more human, restoring the balance of that human touch against the, you know, pervasive tech touch where appropriate. And, you know, if we are to be successful in the future, it's going to be meeting people where they are and serving their needs and interests first. And I think we've become so enamored of the powerful and inexpensive technology that we've really set these machines off to do a lot of our work for us without truly testing the boundaries of what's scalable and what's unscalable. I think a lot of people will take that personal and human approach and say, oh, that doesn't scale. And so we set it on the side and we stop doing the things that truly emotionally connect with people and make a big difference in our business. But it's hard to measure that difference where it's easy to measure the effects of automation, for example, and time savings and productivity. I'm air quoting for listeners, productivity. We're so enamored of the efficiency gains that we lose sight of what's truly effective. So I'm not saying throw anything away, but it's a restoring the balance. So we really try to echo that theme and tie all the way back to the beginning and run that thread from the very first opening of the introduction through all 16 of those chapters there at the conclusion. So that's the structure.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break,
you know, when you wind up in a group text message or a group LinkedIn message and all of a sudden you pick up your phone and there are 85 messages there and you're like, what is all this? And now you're in this group message that you never expected to be in. It would have been better as a one-off. You know, so there are all these kind of innocent, you know, pollution. It slows us down. It confuses us. It frustrates us. It distracts us from why we turned our laptop on or why we picked up our phone, etc.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. So let's touch upon the first one, the digital pollution bit. Where do you stand on that?
There are many kinds of digital pollution. We offer a little three-tiered taxonomy of it. Not the most common, but you know, the easiest and most fun one to talk about is the one that's just kind of frustrating or silly or annoying. That's the case where, you know, there's a typo or an autocorrect and you misunderstand it and it's perhaps embarrassing or even comical and you kind of settle that out. Hopefully it's with a friend rather than a coworker or perhaps even a supervisor or a customer, but it happens to us all the time. And sometimes it's potentially dangerous, but you know, typically we can kind of, oh, sorry, that was a, you know, typo autocorrect. Or we use that emoji. And we think that it lets someone know that we're joking, but it really feels to them like it's passive aggressive and there's a little bit of confusion there. So there's no ill intent. This is also, you know, when you wind up in a group text message or a group LinkedIn message and all of a sudden you pick up the your phone and there are 85 messages there and you're like, what is all this? And now you're in this group message that you never expected to be in. It would have been better as a one-off. You know, so there are all these kind of innocent, you know, pollution. It slows us down. It confuses us. It frustrates us. It distracts us from why we turned our laptop on or why we picked up our phone, et cetera. On the far other end of digital pollution is this really dangerous, threatening, what we call intentional pollution. Now, unlike environmental pollution, in environmental pollution, no one really intends to create that pollution. It's waste. It costs the company money to produce this output, whether it poisons our air, water, or soil. They're creating something that is a waste product, an inefficiency in their production process. Whatever they're trying to create or deliver, it's producing this waste. And instead of actually taking responsibility for it and paying for that inefficiency and building that cost into their cost structure, they cheat. And they're a little bit greedy and selfish, and they just dump it out onto the public in one way or another, and we pay for that in a variety of ways. Interestingly, so there's no motivation to create the pollution, but perhaps there's a motivation to permit it to be pushed out and externalized onto the public rather than taking responsibility. And certainly that's a greedy, dangerous, selfish thing to do. But with digital pollution, when you think about it, there is a great deal of profit motive in creating this intentional, dangerous digital pollution. Ransomware, malware, phishing schemes, cyber attacks, denial of service, all of these things where people can set up these traps and it's producing money for them while they sleep, right? And it's super dangerous and it's constantly moving ahead as cybersecurity and other things are trying to catch it. Now, most people reading this book certainly have to be aware that they're operating in an environment that has a lot of intentional pollution in it. It means, is it safe to download this? Is it safe to click that link? Is this from who it says it's from? We've all received those emails that are like, you know, your PayPal account is about to be shut down. And then you hover over the email address and it is not from PayPal. And they want you to click that link in order to trigger something, you know? And so anyway, it means that trust is harder to build and more fragile in these spaces, again, even if you're not polluting. Now, those are the two extremes, and the big fat middle is consequential pollution, and you're likely creating it whether you intend to or not. And so we explore what is this consequential pollution, its subjective nature that each person gets to decide. Kind of a really easy way to think about it is, for those people listening that are not segmenting their database or reaching out in a personal way, they're just taking every email address they've ever received or, heaven forbid, buying contact lists and just dumping messages and ads at those people, it's definitely polluting the environment. There's not enough discipline there. There's not enough focus. And you're teaching people to ignore and delete you. As a consequence, those humans' behaviors are teaching the machines to ignore and delete you, because machines will increasingly control what we see, what we have access to. It's protecting our time and attention. It's operating on our behalf. And so we need to think about the actual real immeasurable or difficult to measure consequences, including negative word of mouth that some of our digital behavior is creating. And so there are a lot of costs and consequences. That's perhaps more than you maybe wanted on that response. And there's a lot more, of course, we can talk about. But it's important to understand that, A, we're creating digital pollution very often, even though we don't intend to. It's highly subjective, and each person gets to decide on a contextual moment-by-moment basis whether or not you are polluting their social feed or their inbox or their text messages or whatever, that this polluted environment hurts us and our ability to reach people and get attention and build trust and create engagement whether or not we're polluting. And of course, we need to all acknowledge that we probably have some behaviors to manage all the pollution that faces us every single day.
Do you see emergence of personal AI bots where I can set up a system which will say, okay, these are the people or these are the things I want to look at, the rest you just filter out, whether it's my inside my mail or inside my LinkedIn profile or inside whatever. Do you see any signs of such technologies coming up?
Yes, absolutely. I think the earliest version of it are all of the kind of, they're the if this, then that type solutions where it's typically a third party, although someone like Gmail, years ago, they put in a lot of inboxes that tabbed environment where they're, preemptively saying, this is probably a promotion. This is probably an update. This is probably related to social. This is probably relevant to you, so it's in the primary. This is probably spam, so it's in spam. And of course, marketers and salespeople were out of their minds about it. Like, oh my gosh, how dare they, put my mass blast marketing message in a promotion folder? How do I get around that? And it's just this like, you're mass blasting 6,200 people at a time with a uniform message without much specific care. Like, what do you think should happen to that? So those are some of the crude things. And then people can, again, use third-party software to write, rule sets. And some of the tools themselves do allow you to write rule sets. And then what happens is slowly over time, we're going to see more and more of the, whether it's basic automation, like a, if this happens, then make that happen. That's basic automation. We'll certainly see, and I'm sure it exists in a tool like Superhuman, for example, that's a kind of a meta email management thing that comes up in the book. We'll see more of the machines taking over those rule sets and perhaps observing which rules are effective, which rules does this individual human being accept, and which rules do they kind of like work around. Like if I write a rule that sequesters someone's messages to a different place, but I find myself manually going over there and pulling them to where I want to see them, the AI is going to recognize, perhaps even more than our own conscious brain will, that rule around that deliverer or that source of the information isn't a great rule. And so maybe we'll kind of start subverting the rule, testing whether it should be subverted. And if the human keeps responding, the machine will say, okay, good, let's rewrite that rule. And so it really, in a lot of ways, starts to trigger a lot of concepts around AI, like neural networks and, what patterns are reinforced and what patterns are violated and, how are we behaving? Because we're not consciously aware of many of our decisions. If we were consciously aware of every one of our decisions that we made, we would be exhausted by breakfast.
Absolutely. Let's move on to the experts that you cover. I think 10 or 11 of them have been featured in your book. What were the major areas of agreement that you found and those of disagreement? You didn't mention about the virtual background, but what are the basic agreements and disagreements that you found?
Sure. So just a quick pass on the experts. Again, these are people that we knew or knew of. There's several of them are sales experts, sales trainers, sales like architects. They're designing go-to-market strategies and things like that. We have a marketing futurist from Salesforce. We have an emotional intelligence expert with 7 U.S. patents in the analysis of facial coding data. We have the CEO of Remax, one of the most recognized brands in real estate in the world. We have the first salesperson and the 6th employee at HubSpot. We just have a number of really great people. Certainly they all agree that we need to find a balance and that technology needs to be deployed for the benefit of humans. And by that, I don't just mean for the benefit of our prospects and our customers. I mean the benefit for our employees. And so we need to find that balance. And so, equipping our team members with instant, easy, filtered looks at who this person on the phone is, and this isn't all new stuff, but it's something that not enough companies are paying attention to. Smarter systems that do send the right stuff to the right people at the right time in messages that have their best interests in mind and can communicate that we're aligned in these things. How to be more present on video calls. I think so many of us through the pandemic, and again, you won't hear the words pandemic or COVID in this book, but you can immediately relate to it. All of us know how to turn our cameras on, But then we also know how to look and feel distracted and disinterested, even if we don't intend to. And so how can we be more conscious and present, not just for the benefit of communicating more effectively, you know, responding in time, but more importantly, to make other people feel like they're seen and heard and understood and appreciated, which is the thing that humans want above all. So what are some strategies for doing that right now? For example, this whole time I can see you out of my peripheral vision, but I'm looking directly into the camera and trying to make eye contact with you so that you know that, you know, this is important and that you can feel me connecting with you in a more direct manner. That's a difficult art, especially if you have four or five or six people on the screen at one time. Yeah. And then another layer of skill, how do we do that when the person's not even with us, right? In a recorded video message, how do we make it feel like they are present with us when in fact they're not? You know, it's one thing just to turn the camera on and spit out a script that's basically the video version of a crappy email that no one's responding to right now. And we think, gosh, you know, if I put it in a video, I'll get more attention. Or if I simply put someone's name on a whiteboard, or heaven forbid, fake someone's name onto a whiteboard and just read this crappy email that no one's responding to right now. But if I do it in this new channel, it's going to magically be better. You know, so we knock down some of those illusions. There's also a significant call to focus on the outcomes and not the activities. So many, especially on the sales and marketing side, but really throughout our organizations, we can get really enamored of measuring the activities, like what activities were performed, and just this assumption that it's actually driving the outcome. So again, we look to get really efficient with a high volume of activities in a short amount of time, and we can high five each other and say, man, we did 500 of this activity as a team today. And what happens is the goal, the actual outcome, whether that's booked meetings or whether it's a reply rate or whether it's a renewal of a subscription or whatever the real desired outcome of those activities is, that goal gets supplanted by the activity goal, and we lose sight of why we're actually performing the activity. And so there's just a number of things. As for virtual backgrounds, really quickly, there are a couple very strong adherents, and they make very strong arguments with a couple of caveats. If you can do it cleanly and you can do it technically well, and you make it about the other person, that the background either brings your message to life and reinforces its message, or it's really about the other person. For example, you know, there's a story of a guy that took a video off of YouTube of the exterior of a company's building and mocked, you know, using it as a virtual background, mocked like he was outside their building. Now he didn't try to do it in a way that convinced them that he was physically outside their office. He did it in a playful way, but that's about the recipient, and it shows this level of intentionality and care. On the other side, most people aren't doing it with that level of care. Most people aren't doing it in a clean way, so you get like the weird edges, and it feels like fake and not like really virtual. It feels like awkward, and it begs the question. The human mind really wants to know, so where are they really? And so it kind of can create a discrepancy there. So you'll hear both sides of that argument, but the pro side is made very, very adamantly in a couple of chapters.
Interesting. So let's cruise to the future, which is your 16th chapter, which you mentioned. What is the future of human-centered communication?
This is the future. I mean, one of the things I've been calling it in presentations recently is today's path to tomorrow's revenue. As I mentioned, we're going to be spending more time in digital, virtual, and online spaces.
Yeah.
In addition, these spaces are going to be noisier and more polluted than ever. It is going to be increasingly difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to get attention from people that we don't have familiarity and trust with already. Likewise, that trust is more fragile. One of the interviews that I did after writing the book, after I wrote the book and after I read this, a guy named Dr. Nick Morgan, he talks at length with me about how our virtual relationships naturally degrade over time. Now, we don't have the ability here to talk about what the problems are with digital communication, what the unique qualities are inside the human mind that drive that, but we need to be aware of that. And so we are teaching people with every message and experience that we create, whether or not we are worthy of their attention in the future, whether or not we are worthy of being familiar and trusted, certainly delivery of value or something useful to them is part of that process. And so we want to get into that positive loop of anytime our name or our brand name gets in front of this person, it triggers something that's, again, not conscious, but feels something like, oh, I like hearing from these people, or gosh, these people always have my best interest in mind, or I can't wait to see what this person is going to share with me, right? And that only happens when we earn attention the right way, value that attention by delivering something useful or interesting or helpful, and doing that in a repeated fashion. Now, if we don't do that, we're teaching those people, and as a consequence, the machines, that we may or may not be worth their attention the next time that it comes up. And so this loop of either falling into the ignore delete pile, we may never get away from that pile. I mentioned superhuman before. Not only can we say, I don't want messages from this person anymore, we can also say, I don't want messages from this domain anymore. So if you have a rogue salesperson that's being overly aggressive, or if you have a bad system that's kind of sending garbage messages to people that don't really have their best interest in mind, that are not human-centered, that do not focus on the needs and wants of the other person, at least on equal footing as your own needs and wants and interests as the sender, they can prevent anyone from your entire company from reaching them again in the future. Like, that's already available today, and it's only going to go more that way because, you know, it's certainly, we all know that one of the most precious things that we have in this era, 2021, 2022, and beyond, is our time and our attention. It becomes very, very valuable. In many cases, it becomes more valuable than the money itself. And so certainly machines are going to operate in our interests. We're going to seek tools and processes and filters and systems that protect our time and our attention. And we need to know that we're operating this environment. And we need to know that no matter how many machines are put on these tasks and these opportunities, that people are still ultimately behaving in a way that's based on how they think, which is based on how they feel, which is subconscious, it's emotional, it's pattern-based, and we need to be on the positive side of that pattern, and we can't cheat our way there. We need to earn it.
One final question. You know, there is no debating of the fact that we are in a possibly in a hyper-communicative society, right? So,
yes.
So even if you're thinking of the quantum of communication you get from your friends and known circle, which have nothing to do with your business or your professional life, itself is overwhelming. And obviously, we are still grappling with how much we should forward, how much we should share, what is, do we have some responsibility of what we share, do we see whether it's fake news and so on and so forth. And these are also new nuanced issues that are emerging, which we are not really very conversant with in basically, right? Because it's a new era. When it comes to business, we are getting 10 times more than what our personal network is pushing to us without asking for it. Where do you think this balance is going to settle, especially when you talk about human-centered communication?
Yeah, I think once the consequences of continuing to operate from this more of a mass mindset, mass production, mass media, uniformity, homogeneity, you know, most of the tech is going toward where it needs to go, which is beyond segmented to personalized to ultimately to markets of one. We want to reach people and address people in a truly personal way. And that's what machines are doing. But there's still this, you know, this human attachment to volume and, you know, larger numbers and, you know, settling for an improvement from 2.6% to 2.9%. We can high five ourselves on that increase in conversion rate while ignoring the 97.1% failure rate. And how much of that 97.1% failure rate, my made up scenario there, is actually super negative, is in that ignore, delete, block by humans, ignore, delete, block by machines. And as that grows and as it really starts to cost us something, because one of the numbers you'll hear is, you know, if you want to get someone's attention, you know, in a prospecting situation, you now need 17 impressions instead of, you know, just a few years ago it was 12, and a few years before that it was 7. It's like, you can continue to play that game, but that's not the winning play because it just gets more difficult and more expensive. Yeah. And so either the business model will force it or someone will wake up and know intuitively, again, basic golden rule treatment. The golden rule comes up a couple of times in the book, and it's present in every single religious and philosophical system that you encounter. Perhaps not every single one, but dozens. I mentioned a couple dozen in the beginning of chapter two. If we think about why we're sending our team members off to do things that we know we hate, we know we don't respond to, we know don't work when we receive them, why would we do that to our potential customers? Absolutely. And so once we kind of wake up to that dynamic a little bit, we'll either wake up to it because we'll start to realize efficiency and effectiveness gains by being a little bit more conscious and intentional, or the business model will force it. It's no longer profitable to do this junk anymore. So we have to change. One of those two things will force it, but I think we'll come out on the right side of it. Last thing here, for folks that aren't familiar with human-centered design, IDEO, who we mentioned in the book, is its foremost proponent, practitioner, adherent. They've been doing it for decades. They designed the first Apple mouse using human-centered design principles. They've designed water systems in Africa using these design systems and principles, and all kinds of other products and services and systems and processes. So whether you learn about it by reading human-centered communication or listening to a podcast like this or listening in on a webinar or a presentation that Steve or I give, or you just go out and learn about human-centered design on your own, the basic principles, if you start applying them to more of the systems, whether they're communication systems or other systems, or even unique individual messages as a product unto itself, or in your product or service design on whole, you will see benefits to your business. You'll see more engaged and more satisfied employees, and you'll also see more satisfied and engaged prospects and customers. And that is a net benefit to humanity as a whole, not just to your business success.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Ethan, I can literally continue for the next half hour. There are so many points here. It's impossible to sort of encapsulate all of them. I do hope that we'll have opportunity to talk again. There are so many pointers that I want to talk about, and I really, really enjoyed our chat, and I hope you had a good time.
I absolutely did. I really appreciate it. Happy to talk about the pom-pom story on your other show. Happy to talk about these themes and actually monologue a little less and converse a little bit more. I'm just obviously really passionate about these ideas. I appreciate the opportunity to talk through them, and I'd be happy to be in conversation with you again anytime.
Ethan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books with Peter Kohan, Park Howell, Julie Hansen, and Andrea Walls. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.